Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Tim Gregory. He is a cosmochemistry research scientist at the British Geological Survey in Nottingham. We're talking about his new book, Meteorite: How Stones from Outer Space Made Our World. Tim, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book. I learned so much from reading this book.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Well, and I want to mention to the audience, this book is chock full of information, and we're only going to be able to sort of skim a little few things out of the book, but let's get rolling. Meteorites are basically rocks falling from outer space, but the important thing you point out right away is they're not from interstellar space, they're from interplanetary space. Explain the difference.
Yes, that's exactly right. So meteorites, they've come a long way to the Earth. They've travelled all the way from the asteroid belt, most of them, which is the region of our solar system between Mars and Jupiter, which, you know, it's still hundreds of millions of miles away. But on an astronomical scale, it's still really in our cosmic neighbourhood. Meteorites come from within our solar system rather than outside our solar system. But as I do talk about in the book, there are some components tucked away inside meteorites that are interstellar. And so, you know, although they come from our planetary neighborhood, they do take us to the stars as well.
Well, the most important thing, and we'll talk more about this throughout the interview, but and what I learned from your book is that they can tell us the history of the early solar system.
Yes, that's exactly right. So one of the cornerstones of geology and earth sciences is understanding the Earth's history. And you know, you can go hundreds of millions of years back in time using the rocks on the Earth, and indeed you can even go billions of years back in time. But one of the things that is, you know, we don't often think about the fact that we live on an active planet, but we do. Geology isn't just something that happened in the past, it's happening now. There are volcanoes and plate tectonics and the weather. And so the rocks of the Earth are constantly being unmade and reworked into new rocks. And so this great recycling process of rocks means that there's only a limit to how far back in time the Earth rocks can take us. Because if you go back far enough, rocks simply don't survive from the very earliest history. And so to go back to the very, very earliest history of our planet and indeed the solar system, you need meteorites. They're the only solid objects that survive from the era of solar system formation 4.5 billion years ago. And that's one of the reasons why they're so important.
I want to back up a bit because this was the first time I ever came across the word cosmochemistry. And reading your book, it sounds like cosmochemistry, in fact, as a science, has been around for a while. Was it always called that?
Well, there is a journal that has the name cosmochemistry in it that's been around since the 50s. So it's at least 70 years old.
Wow.
Cosmochemistry is not a subject that you teach in high school.
I was going to say, you can't major in it as an underclassman, can you?
No, but I came close. I graduated in geology with planetary science. And
nice.
It was during my undergraduate degree that I discovered the science of meteorites. And there is a lens through which you can study meteorites called cosmochemistry. And as the name suggests, it's the chemistry of outer space using, well, mostly meteorites, but also other things like the Apollo moon rocks. That classes as cosmochemistry too.
Now let's get to some of the basics. About you mentioned that the source for many of the meteorites, not all of them, but most of them, is from the asteroid belt. And for listeners in the audience who don't know what the asteroid belt is or have never heard about it, talk about what the origin of the asteroid belt is.
Yes. So the origin of the asteroid belt, we have to go back pre-solar system, so pre 4.5 billion years. Our solar system was a giant interstellar cloud of gas and dust called a nebula. And many people have probably seen images of nebula. They're beautiful, especially when taken with, you know, telescopes like Hubble. These vast glowing incandescent clouds that drape across the stars. Now, sometimes these nebula, they collapse in on themselves under their own gravity. And this is essentially how stars form. If enough nebula collapses down, the collapsing clump of nebula becomes dense enough and hot enough to spark fusion reactions. and then it ignites as a star. Now, it's around these stars that planets form. You see, not all of the nebula falls onto the star. Some of it goes into orbit around it, and it's from these thin wisps of nebula orbiting young stars that planetary systems evolve. Now, when they start life, they're disks that are essentially made pretty much entirely of gas. But as these disks cool down, they begin to crystallize into tiny motes of dust. And it's these motes of dust that clump together in their, well, countless numbers of them clump together to form planets. But before you get to planethood, you have to pass through all of the varying sizes, you know, all the way down from dust-sized pieces of rock all the way up to something like the Earth. And the asteroids are really that process that hasn't made it to completion yet. The asteroids are the debris left over from this era of planet formation. They are rocky worlds, but they never quite made it to planethood. And because they remained so small, they cooled down incredibly quickly, which is why the rocks were frozen in time all the way back right after they formed. And we find these asteroids mostly today in the asteroid belt. And the reason that they never clumped together to form a planet is because of the gravitational influence of Jupiter. It prevented them from doing so. And so they've always been this band of solitary wanderers orbiting the sun in this sort of donut-shaped ring of debris. And occasionally they send a piece earthwards as a meteorite.
Yeah, they sort of ding into each other, and then occasionally a piece will fly off, and then you have meteorites. But and in the recent sort of decade, we've actually done some incredible close observation of some of these meteorites, and I'll tell you, they look wild.
Oh, don't they just?
There's one that sort of looked like a dog bone. It was like this. It was like big at both ends and then sort of skinny in the middle.
Yeah, they come in all shapes and sizes, asteroids. And one of the things I enjoyed the most about writing my book, Meteorite, was that I got to delve back into some of the really old scientific literature from the 1800s
astronomical
objects. Oh, it was fantastic because, you know, as a research scientist, you don't often go back to papers in the 1800s. and so to have an excuse to do that was brilliant. And the way that these asteroids were described, well, they were just simply points of light down a telescope. They couldn't really tell anything about them. Some of them flickered, and you know, they sort of blinked in the sky, and the astronomers of the day correctly put that down to them tumbling. You know, you can imagine these worlds tumbling, and as they do, like a disco ball almost, you know, they change their reflectance as they tumble. But they really didn't know anything about them. They were just points of light in the sky. But like you said, we've done loads of cool space missions over the last few decades to go and image these worlds up close. And I think it surprised everybody because everybody just expected these asteroids to be sort of lumps of rock that were sort of dead world.
Each one seems to have a different set of characteristics.
Absolutely. The asteroids are as varied and as wonderful as the planets. And although their geological history was short-lived, it's by no means less interesting and less rich than those of the planet. They're worlds in their own right.
Now, if I understand your book correctly, we can actually determine the origin of some of the meteorites based on their chemistry, based on their mineralogy. We can actually say this one came from this asteroid because it has a similar composition.
Yes.
I thought that was brilliant. I never knew about that.
It's amazing, and it's worth just highlighting the enormity of the challenge. There are 60,000 meteorites. That's 60,000 meteorites we have on Earth in the worldwide collection, and more are discovered each year. But in the asteroid belt, there are millions of asteroids. And so pairing the stones that we have here on Earth with the asteroids in the asteroid belt is really one of the holy grails of cosmic chemistry. And truth be told, we haven't made that much progress towards it. It's very, very difficult to say, yes, this stone came from that asteroid and this stone came from that asteroid, etc. But there are a few exceptions, and I do go into some detail about that in the book because it's sort of one of these rare cases. You know, you might expect that we know where the meteorites come from, but we actually don't, except in the very few circumstances. And
look at the fact that you could do that amazes me.
Yeah, Totally. And even then, it's not settled. I've seen people stand up at scientific conferences and shout at each other over this sort of thing.
Yeah, but that's what scientific conferences are about. If you don't get to yell at somebody, it's not a conference.
Absolutely. And it's by matching the properties of meteorites that we can measure here on the Earth with telescopic observation of meteorites that we get from telescopes and spacecraft and things like that.
Now, I want to talk about the difference between a fall and a find.
Ooh. So, you know, I guess cosmochemistry, a large part of it is geology. And like all of natural scientists, geologists love classifying things. And there are many, many different ways that you can classify meteorites. But one of the most simple ways is you can classify meteorites into falls and finds. Now, falls are meteorites that people see falling and then go and pick them up. So, you know, sometimes that can be within minutes, or sometimes it can be within days if someone, you know, roughly saw where it fell and then went out looking for it.
Well, I just want to stop you there right there. Why is it important for cosmochemists to find the meteorite as soon as they can after they fall?
It's incredibly important. Falls are scientifically some of the most valuable meteorites because, you know, sometimes it's mere hours between these stones being in space and then they end up in a university being curated and, you know, kept under dry, oxygen-free conditions. As soon as a meteorite lands on the Earth, it gets attacked from all sides. Firstly, it's attacked by the oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. It's attacked by the rain. It's attacked by microbial life. It's attacked by all sorts. And over time, this overprints the celestial things that are written in the meteorites. And they begin to become obscured by the earthly effects, if you like. Whereas with the falls, they don't have time to be weathered. They don't have time to be rained on. So they're incredibly scientific valuable. But they're also very rare. To see a meteorite falling and then go and pick it up is, well, you've won the cosmic jackpot if that ever happens.
Yeah. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Tim Gregory. He's a cosmochemistry research scientist at the British Geological Survey in Nottingham, and we're talking about his book. It is such a great read. Meteorite, How Stones from Outer Space Made Our World. I'm fascinated by some of the places that scientists have found meteorites, and I want to talk about the East Antarctic Ice Sheet. Talk to me.
Gosh.
I mean, that sounds so wild.
Isn't it? Maybe the last place on Earth you would expect to find a treasure trove of meteorites.
but I mean, first of all, talk about how they came across them.
It's quite unbelievable. It was merely by chance in the 1960s that there was a Japanese expedition out to Antarctica, and they weren't geologists. They weren't looking for meteorites, but they happened upon some strange stones that seemed out of place. Now, picture it. You're in the middle of Antarctica. All you can see in every direction for miles is ice, and you come across a rock on the surface of the ice. It sounds crazy, but the only place that rock could have come from is the sky.
That's amazing.
And so they suspected, maybe this is a meteorite. And then they discovered another. And then they discovered another and another. And they had nearly a dozen of them by the end of the expedition. And they thought to themselves, how on earth is it that there are so many meteorites in this very small space of planet? Because the thing about meteorites is that they fall roughly evenly all over the planet. And so to find, you know, 10 of them within a small area, there's something strange going on. And it turns out that the East Antarctic Ice Sheet has this amazing property where it flows a little bit like really thick treacle. You know, this thing flows really slowly. But as it does, all of the meteorites that pitter-patter down upon the East Antarctic Ice Sheet get taken along for the ride, a little bit like a natural conveyor belt. And there are areas on the East Antarctic Ice Sheet where these meteorites all get concentrated. They get dumped by the ice, and they accumulate in literally astronomical numbers. Most of the meteorites that we know of come from East Antarctica for this reason. The ice sheet naturally concentrates them. It's just wonderful and so unexpected.
Is the Sahara another place to look for them?
The Sahara is another place. And the thing about the Sahara is it's a similar argument with the Antarctic meteorites. If you're in the middle of the desert and and you find a rock on the surface of the sand.
Right, something is up.
There are no rivers.
Something's weird.
There are no mountains for this thing to come from. It must have come from the sky. And so there are people who dedicate their lives to scouring the sands of the Sahara looking for meteorites. It's something that I might like to do one day, maybe for a holiday or something. I've never found a meteorite, but I would love to.
I mean, it's basically what you do is you just sort of drive or walk along until you see an anomalous rock.
Yeah, people drive and, you know, stand on the back of the car, and people get good at spotting it, apparently, after a couple of weeks. Yeah.
You know what? I would love to do that, too. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, wouldn't it be amazing? Celestial contraband in the Sahara.
Well, that's right, because are there laws against removing those materials from the Sahara?
Well, in some of the countries that the Sahara Desert encroaches on, there are laws about the exportation of meteorites, and they're, you know, understandably seen as belonging to the nation on which they fell. You know, these natural treasures, they're precious. However, there are some countries where it is legal to export meteorites from, and so the Saharan meteorite trade is a little bit of a black market, to be honest. It's not always clear exactly where the meteorites come from, and you know, many of them work their way out of the African countries in suitcases and things like that. It's a little bit controversial, shall we say, although scientifically they're very important, but there are some institutions, particularly a lot of the museums around the world, they refuse to house Saharan meteorites for that reason, because they're not exactly sure where they came from.
Now, you answer a question in your book after making a statement, and I'm so glad you did. Some 10,000 tons of extraterrestrial material falls to Earth each year. And the obvious question that everybody's thinking about, 10,000 tons, how come we aren't up to our armpits in meteorites?
Yeah, it sounds like a lot, doesn't it? 10,000 tons.
It is a lot. So it doesn't sound like a lot. It is a lot. 10,000 tons of anything is a lot.
It's barely noticeable, though, isn't it? It's one of those numbers where the first time I read it, I thought, no way, is that true? And then you do the math. You take 10,000 tons and you divide it by the surface area of the Earth, and it amounts to basically nothing, okay? It's nothing. I included it in the book. I calculated that one of the biggest parks in London, St. James's Park, is the equivalent of a teaspoon of rock sprinkled over the entire area of St. James's Park every year. It's barely anything. And most of that 10,000 tons falls as dust. We literally don't notice it. You've probably got some in your hair right now. It falls all the time. This steady, I'm being serious, it's absolutely everywhere, this stuff, but it's hardly noticeable because it's so small, this very steady pitter-patter of cosmic dust. A very tiny fraction of meteorites or anything that we would resent, that, you know, that we would consider stone-sized.
Now, there's a real taxonomy to meteorites, and you detail this in the book very, very well. And you talk a lot about the real chemistry of each one, but let's talk about some basics. Is it chondrites, chondrites, and achondrites?
Yes, you, that's exactly right. You definitely read the book. That's brilliant. One of my wishes when I set off writing this book was to get some of the sort of technical cosmochemistry literature into the mainstream narrative. There we are. We just said the word chondrite on radio, which is great.
I'll try to drop it into to cocktail party conversation too. But what's the one of the two major separations. So how would you describe both of them?
So there are two major families of meteorites, as you said. There are the chondrites and the achondrites. Now, they're fundamentally different in that the chondrites originate from asteroids that never melted, and the achondrites originate from asteroids that did melt. And now, if you remember, I mentioned about this dust that the solar system coalesced from. Well, because the chondrites originate from asteroids that never melted, they preserve this dust. They preserve the dust from which the solar system coalesced. And so, you know, the Earth, this massive planet that we all live our lives on, it was assembled from minute pieces of dust. And the way that we study that dust is through the chondrites. Now, if you go far enough back in Earth's history, Earth is made of this dust too. But because it's geologically active, that dust was destroyed billions of years ago. Now, the achondrites, they come from asteroids that did melt, and they therefore are some of the most unexpected rocks that you might expect to fall from the sky, because generally when rocks melt, you get volcanoes. And we see very, very strong evidence that there were volcanic, that there was volcanic activity on the surface of these asteroids 4.5 billion years ago, wow, which is just the most awesome thing to try and picture. You know, millions of asteroids orbiting the sun, many of them with volcanoes on their surface. It's kind of sci-fi, but it's real.
Now, your book has several of these stories of individual meteorite falls, that each one is fascinating and it contributes to our overall knowledge of cosmic chemistry. But I want to talk about one because it fascinated me. And that was the Murchison meteorite, 1969, September 28th, in Victoria, Australia. Yeah. Now, this meteorite comes down, it fragments, and there's fragments all over the place. But the thing that got me is they smelled.
Yeah, how weird is that?
That's weird!
Yes. It fell on a Sunday morning when people were getting ready for church, and apparently a couple of people bunked off church that morning and went looking for the meteorite, which I thought was hilarious. I probably would have done the same.
Oh, yeah,
of course. And the people who came across these stones noticed a very strange smell emanating from them. So as if a stone falling from the sky wasn't strange enough, they also smelled. And I can personally confirm that this is the case because I've smelled this type of meteorite.
So what does it smell like?
It's kind of a combination of paint stripper and damp towel. You know when you leave a towel out for too long and it goes a bit damp, a bit musty. It's a little bit like that, if I'm being honest. I remember it well from my student days.
So what was going on with these? Were these carbonaceous chondrites?
Yes, this is a very special type of meteorite called a carbonaceous chondrite. And as the name suggests, many of these carbonaceous chondrites contain carbon. And that's what you're smelling with this type of meteorite. It's the organic compounds leaking from the surface into the air. And the complexity of these organic molecules in meteorites like Murchison is absolutely staggering. Again, it's perhaps the last thing you would expect to discover in a stone that fell from outer space. These are not just simple hydrocarbons just made from, you know, carbon and hydrogen. They've got phosphorus in them, nitrogen. They've got all sorts, and some of them are hundreds of atoms big. They're massive, and the most intriguing thing about that is perhaps the role that these molecules may have had to play in the origin of life on Earth. Organic molecules are nicknamed the molecules of life because, of course, life on Earth is carbon based, and in fact, the molecules that proteins are based on, amino acids, we find them in abundance in meteorites. The building blocks of life are common in these meteorites. It's staggering.
And that leads to another story. I don't know if we're going to have enough time to finish, but there were people who claimed that they found life in a meteorite.
Oh, yeah, that's been claimed a few times, but perhaps most famously, it was a meteorite that was, well, It's a very strange meteorite because it actually originates from the planet Mars. It's a very rare type of meteorite that doesn't originate from an asteroid. It's a piece of Mars. And some researchers claimed to have found fossil life in these meteorites, but that's not very widely believed, actually. It seems that it was some sort of artifact imprinted on the stone during preparation, but it does go to show that you have to be very, very careful when you think you've made a big scientific discovery. You're the easiest person in the world to fool, and that was a real example of that.
And that's a tough thing to live down in your career, by the way, when you make a huge claim like that.
Well, some of the authors of the original paper are still adamant that it is life. I wouldn't say it's much of a debate. It's not very widely accepted in the community, but there are still some people who firmly believe it. I personally don't. I read lots of the literature for my research with meteorite and came to the conclusion that, nah, probably not. Not this time, anyway.
Well, you know, people are probably thinking, and we're going to finish up with this, is how are meteorites coming from Mars?
Oh, they come from Mars in the same way that they come from asteroids. They're sort of knocked off the surface by impact. And one of the obvious questions is, well, how do we know they come from Mars? And the answer is, well, one of the lines of evidence, I'd say the strongest line of evidence, is that in these meteorites, we find tiny little pockets of gas, and the chemistry of that gas is identical to the Martian atmosphere as measured on the surface of Mars by the rovers. And so these meteorites, you know, they're some of the most important meteorites because they're pieces of Mars that we can study in the laboratory. But I think they hold a real symbolic value as well, because I've no doubt that one day humans will go to Mars themselves and pick up rocks on the surface of the red planet with their own hands. But for now, these meteorites are the only ways that we can get our hands on the red planet. And so in that sense, I guess they really are pieces of the future home of humanity, which is, well, I often think that when I see Martian meteorites.
But how are they leaving Martian gravity? Is it because of a volcano eruption, or is it because of a impact of interplanetary material hitting Mars with such impact that the stuff goes up into the atmosphere and out?
Yes, it's exactly that. They get hit so hard by an impactor that they get blasted off the surface entirely. It's quite difficult to do that because Mars has a thin atmosphere which tends to slow things down. But Mars is quite a small planet. In fact, some people don't even really consider it a planet. They consider it a planetary embryo. Huh. So it doesn't require that much force to get a rock off the surface, especially when you compare it with a planet like the Earth, where it's probably impossible to get a rock off the surface of the Earth without completely destroying it. And so it's unlikely that we find Earth meteorites on the surface of Mars, but we do find Martian meteorites on the surface of the Earth.
Are there lunar meteorites?
There are lunar meteorites, yes. And the reason that we know that there are meteorites from the moon is because we can compare them directly.
Right, we have a collection of moon rocks.
Exactly, yes, exactly. And you know, there are lots of scientists interested in studying the moon, and as you can imagine, it's very difficult to get hold of Apollo rocks, so the lunar meteorites are a real nice sort of stopgap for that.
Oh wow. We're completely out of time, and we have barely scratched the surface of this book. My guest is Tim Gregory. He's a cosmochemistry research scientist at the British Geological Survey in Nottingham, and we're talking about his book. It's one of my favorite science books written for a general public of the last 10 years. Meteorite, How Stones from Outer Space Made Our World. Tim, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you for the invitation to talk. It's been fab.
You're listening to... fab, I love that. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.